Good evening, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio, Sinoland, on the D-Day beaches of Normandy in France. And I've got an old friend and comrade back on the show again tonight, Bruce Lero. How are you doing, Bruce?
Doing great. Looking forward to this discussion.
Likewise. Bruce has been on has been a guest on my show three times now. And I've done at least one of his guest articles on China Rising Radio Sinoland. In spite of the fact that some people might define what Bruce talks about as being kind of heady or intellectual, I can prove to anybody that tens of thousands of people have accessed those interviews on my website. So he obviously has something that interests people, and he's able to talk to people maybe about something that they didn't understand before, but they want to understand now. So Bruce has just come out with a part one and part two article on the Greenville Post, another great common friend of ours. I'm not going to go into all the introduction about his website and Twitter and books. I'll put all that in there because this is his fourth time now, and I want to get straight to the meat of the matter. And Bruce just came out with two articles on the Greenville Post, and they're incredibly fascinating. And so I invited him on to tell us about the Promethean City Builders, part one and part two. And he's kind of taken part two. And of course, I'll put the reference for both part one and part two, actually on his website, Socialist Planning Beyond Capitalism. So take it away, Bruce.
Okay, Jeff. Well, one of the things I had five points I wanted to make, and I'll just tell you what they are, and then we can go into detail about it. The first thing that interested me is to try to understand what does it take for people in the West to join the multipolarists in the East? And my thesis is that the forces of the left in the West need to organize themselves again around the lines of the Enlightenment and become city builders. So that's one way to sort of join with what's going on in Russia and China. And I think many of people on the left have sort of abandoned the Enlightenment and gotten into a lot of romantic stuff, at least the anarchists and the social democrats have. So that's the first point. Second point is that there is a group. So the question would be, what group in the United States might represent this return to the Enlightenment to connect up with the multipolarists? And there's a group called the Schiller Institute, they were founded by Lyndon LaRouche and his wife, and they are very much pro-Enlightenment. They have some people that have supported them in Canada called the Rising Tide Foundation. And this is Matthew Ehret and Cynthia Chung.
They're good friends of mine.
Right. And yeah. They are really writing a storm up of books about reinterpreting American history. So my second point is that these are people that would provide a link between the West and the Eastern multipolarists in a way that the West can join with them instead of being seen as like a polar opposite. My third point is that the political philosophy of the Anglo-American Empire and finance capitalism is centrism. And in order to fight against that, there have been in some places an attempt to unite the left and the right against the centrists around strategic issues. And so the idea is that if the center is controlling the political spectrum, it's kind of like seen among the left as kind of like bad taste to do anything with the right wing around anything. And I want to contest that and talk a little bit about some stuff that I've seen around left-right that I think is pretty productive. The fourth point is that the forces of the Promethean city builders, which are the multipolarists and the Schiller Institute, their presence makes us think that the linear political spectrum, you know, going from the anarchists on the left to the libertarians on the right and all in between, it's not a good model anymore. We need a new theoretical model of the political spectrum. And I'll go into some examples of why we need that spectrum. And then the fifth part of the article, or this fifth point of the two articles, is probably to me the most interesting and the most I've spent the most time really trying to understand. And that is, in the last 70 years, there have been anti-communist forces in the Anglo-American Empire on the left that present a kind of false opposition. In other words, the new left, beginning in the mid-50s and moving on into the end of the 20th century, has been a real anti-communist left. And that anti-communist left has been shaped by the CIA, the Rockefellers, and they have, I have a table that I've made that sort of shows the values of the new left and how those values serve the Anglo-American Empire. Those are my 5 points. So I'm sure we could talk for 3 days about all these things. You want to start anywhere, or shall I go into detail about this? Or
just to help the people understand this, because you have some maybe not original, but some new vocabulary that may help clarify. So the multipolarists for you are Russia, China, Iran, DPRK, all of the country, basically they shake out to be the communists, Venezuela, Cuba, that are looking for a multilateral, multipolar end to Western, you know, basically rape and plunder of human and earth's resources. Is that what you're saying? Those are the multipolarists. Okay.
Right.
Good.
Right. And then
that's a good group to try to get to know.
Yes. That's right.
And then Lyndon LaRouche, he is, you know, I get their email all the time. Helga, I think her name is Helga LaRouche, yes. is his wife.
Yes.
And I get all the conferences they have, and
that's right.
And they're very, very active. But tell us a little bit about him, because he seems like he seems to be whoever the person thinking about him wants him to be. It's like he's anti-communist, he's pro-China, he's pro-environmental, he doesn't think global warming's happening, he's like a man with 100 faces.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure.
And because obviously your articles, and you consider him to be quite worthwhile getting to know more about.
Sure. So I'm not an expert on Lyndon LaRouche. Cynthia and Matt are much more conversant with him than I am. But I know enough to say, I think, a couple of intelligent things about him. One thing is that he started out as a Marxist. And he, in the late 70s, he wrote what I think is a great book called Dialectical Economics. And it was a really a very original book about capitalist crisis, et cetera. Something happened to him in the early 80s, and I don't really understand the process, but he moved away from Marxism and he moved more towards a kind of a Platonism or a kind of idealism in how he was seeing the world and world history. And I personally, once he did that, I lost interest in him because of that. But the thing that he always supported all the way through his career was the idea, Marx's great idea, that you, in order to develop humanity, you have to develop the productive forces. So you, that means you have to develop high technology. You know, you want to advance science, and you want to be, and you want to create so much abundance that people will work less, and they'll have more time to be creative and more inventive, etc. So I always admired that about him. And then I think in the mid 80s, he started this Schiller Institute with his wife, and they've been very active internationally, and they've gone to conferences that have been very well received. In my article, I talked about the death of Lyndon LaRouche. There was a centennial for his 100-year birthday, if he had been living at this time. And the Russian, I forget what his title was, but he was very high up in the field of economics. And he talked about how important LaRouche was to developing, reinstalling, and reigniting the Russian economy after the disaster of the 90s. And he mentioned that he was very influential in India. So a lot of the new left people, they call him all kinds of names.
Yes, that's the whole, he's hard. They call him everything from A to Z and left to right. It's incredible. It's like they can't figure the guy out.
Yeah, it's like he's a fascist. He's an anti-Semite. They don't really understand what he's doing. They don't know what to make of him, and so they trash him. And they don't really understand how important he is to influential in the Belt Road Initiative in Russia, the reigniting of the Russian and Indian economy. So he's a very valuable person. And the other thing about him is that I want to mention is all of him, the Schiller Institute, they're very much interested in developing the nation state against the forces of globalism. So, you know, they're saying, look, we need to defend the nation state, and they have a very, they have what's called, like, their attitude towards tariffs is protective tariffs as opposed to free trade. And so what that means is they want to see, say, countries in Africa develop their productive forces by having a foreign policy of protectionism so they can develop their industries instead of this free trade, which just lets the imperialists go in and take all the wealth out of the country. So LaRouche is it's like LaRouche has been dead for a few years now, but it's like the Schiller Institute is carrying on this work. And they are, they have been uniting through the People's Party in the United States. They are sort of, they have been uniting with the People's Party around the anti-war, being against the war. And they've also been joined by, Caleb Maupin, who is really a really serious Marxist-Leninist organizer. And they've joined with him, and they've joined with a group of people that you would not believe would ever be part of this, which is the Libertarian Party. So I would think it was maybe in February of this year that the Schiller Institute people, who are not communists, the Marxist-Leninist group, Caleb Maupin, and the Libertarian Party all united about being against the war. And so this is an example of the LaRouche people being able to talk and debate with a communist like Caleb and the Libertarian Party and say, okay, we disagree about these different things, but we are all against the war. And because of that, we're going to have some sort of alliance together. And this is, to me, this is a very valuable thing. I'm not saying people on the left should unite permanently with people on the right, but around strategic issues, it has some value. So There you go. So,
well, Rising Tide Foundation, Matt Arid and Cynthia Chan. In fact, I just interviewed Cynthia about a month ago, and on her new book, yeah, The Black Sun Never Sets, and about the origins of fascism and Anglo-American history, and fascism is as Western and as American as apple pie.
Right.
And they do terrific work, and I've had them on. I've been their guests several times, and they've been my guests several times, and they're doing really great work. Mm-hmm. I will put the Schiller Foundation link on the webpage for this interview, and also the Rising Tide Foundation. They're in Montreal, Canada.
Right.
And so, yeah, we stay in regular touch. They're a lovely couple.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what, you say a city builder, what do you define as the Enlightenment?
Okay.
That we need to get away from Romanticism and get back to Enlightenment. What is Enlightenment in your mind?
Okay. So, the Enlightenment, maybe make three or four points about it without going into detail. One is, I'll sort of contrast the two, Romanticism against the Enlightenment, so you can kind of see the contrast. So the Enlightenment, their basic confidence is in the power of reason. The power of reason to be active in developing science and technology, and the power of reason to create new political institutions that haven't ever existed before. The Romantic people have doubts about the power of reason, and they will say, well, reason has gotten us into all this trouble. Reason has gotten us into, they'll say, well, reason was the application of to the Industrial Revolution, and look what's happened. Look at all the misery that's been produced by the working class. So they doubt reason, and so they will say, and this is like kind of stuff the New Left would say, is that science is just one way of knowing, and there's other ways of knowing. There's intuition and there's emotion and all that. And we need to get back to that, because that's been marginalized. The second thing is that about reason, beside reason, is that the human journey in social evolution, from hunting and gathering to the present, has been a journey where things have gotten, generally, have gotten better for humanity. That life is better now than it was, say, in the hunting and gathering era. And so they would characterize social evolution the way Marx did, which was it was progress. It was a movement from having very little to having very much. And then the opposite of that is the Romantics will say, you know, social evolution is not progress. Progress has created a lot of problems. Look at the ecological setting. Look at the misery of the working class. That the Romantics will say, especially say someone like the anarchists will say, we need to go back to tribal societies. Tribal societies had a great deal of wisdom that got repressed, and we need to go back and we need to recapture that. I would say, I'm thinking, so reason, progress, the Enlightenment would say that we need to overcome our animal urges, our religious superstitions, because in the light of reason, those things don't have a place. That was the past. The Romantics will look at our animal past, and they will say that is something that has been lost that we need to recapture, and we need to get back to that. So the Romantics renounce reason, they renounce progress, they fetishize childhood, you know, like children are wise, adults are stupid. There's lots more contrasts I could make, but that's at least part of it. And
okay.
The Enlightenment has taken really a beating since the rise of the New Left. The New Left is really a movement away from the Enlightenment towards Romanticism. And I would say reasonably, if you look at both the Social Democrats and the anarchists, they fit into that category. They're obviously different from each other, but they do have this romantic orientation in common. And the Leninists don't. The Leninists have the more progress orientation. Mm-hmm. Maoists or even a Trotskyist, they do believe that humanity is moving in the direction of enlightenment. They share enlightenment values.
Hmm.
So
that reminds me, when you talk about intuition and gut feeling, I remember that George W. Bush, it had to do with Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever. Anyway, somebody, he was at a press conference and some reporter asked him, why did you make that decision? Because I had a gut feeling, you know.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh my God,
yeah.
the fate of the world and world peace rests on George W. Bush's gut feeling.
Yeah.
I thought that's just not the way to run a country.
No, and let me go back to this, what you were saying about gut feeling, because, you know, a big part of the New Left has been and this started with the Frankfurt School, where you become more interested in the psychological processes of human beings and less interested in the economic aspects of things. So I don't know if you were part of this, Jeff, or this is just going to show my age, but you know, for you guys that are listening, there was a movement in the early 70s called the Human Potential Movement. And this was a psychological movement that was involved in psychological exploration, which was way beyond therapy. I mean, Esalen Institute had groups on the weekends, and they would have these groups where they would talk about their feelings, and they'd make the emotions the most important thing in being a full human being. And so they would talk about having a gut feeling, like same, just like what you said, is like they would say, What are you feeling inside? Get out of your head and let's talk about your emotions. And that was, of course, that was a psychological movement, not directly connected up to politics, but it seeped into the New Left, and the New Left began to have those types of, that type of orientation as well. So,
anyway. Well, that's sure not the way China runs their country.
Yeah.
It's all based on the famous Han Dynasty quote, you know, that was used, you know, in court records all during the Tang Dynasty and in the 600s to 900s, and the Song Dynasty from 900 to 1200s, and then Mao Zedong picked it up when he was, you know, when he was going to school in Hunan in the early 20th century, and he used it like crazy during China's development, and then it was picked up by Deng Xiaoping, and it's still used by leaders all the time, including Xi Jinping, and that is seek truth from facts. And they do not say seek truth from feelings.
right.
I mean, feelings are great for husbands and wives and children and families, but not to run a country. It's got to be grounded in science and facts and reality. And it just seems to me like since the 1980s, when you think about, you know, the dot-com, those were just fictitious companies. They didn't even exist. They were just holograms for companies. And then, you know, all the other stuff, all the fakery and the lying and I think that all is kind of melds in with what you're talking about, is, you know, imagining what you want instead of figuring out what you want, you know, what you want to do.
Right.
At least that's the way it looks to me.
Right. So I just want to mention, you know, among some of the contrary, some of the business about the New Left is there really was a big part of the New Left that became, as I mentioned, became interested in psychology. There was a person a person you might know, your listeners might know, is a guy named Herbert Marcuse. And Marcuse was a psychoanalyst, considered himself a Marxist, and he talked about how he had good criticism of capitalism, but he really talked about the importance of trying to win Freud, to try to incorporate Freud into New Left ideas. And the New Left kind of got suckered into this. And I would say from maybe the mid 70s all the way into the 90s, what you'll see is a number of Marxists that will try to actually create a synthesis between Marx and Freud and try to combine the two. The problem is that Freud's orientation to the world was mostly opposite of Marxism, and it really cannot be done. And so what happened is, in my opinion, a lot of people that were, say, academics in the 70s and 80s, who could have been social organizers and part of, they could be social organizers, they could be social workers, many of those people became psychotherapists. And once you become psychotherapists, you're talking to people one-on-one. And so it pulled a lot of the intellectual power from the United States, and probably led to a lesser extent in Western Europe, away from political organizing and into therapy rooms, so that you're doing therapy with people. And, you know, Jeff, as you know, one of my first talks with you was, what is socialist psychology? And to be fair to these people, these left-wing Marxists that I was telling you about. Vygotsky was a communist. He was a Marxist communist psychologist who really wanted to build a new kind of psychology. His work got translated into English around the end of the 1970s. So there was an opportunity to try to synthesize Marx with Vygotsky. That would have been a real joining of Marxist economic theory to psychology. But the New Left people ignored that, and they stayed with Freud, and they just carried it out. And we lost a lot of good people, both the population and New Left Marxists, to the field of psychology.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
What, compare and contrast productive forces and unproductive forces.
Okay, so the productive forces are the forces that create more, that create more in the way of wealth. They also improve the standard of living, and they shrink the amount of time that people spend on the job. Those are things that you would say, LaRouche would talk about this. Developing the productive forces means advancing science and technology, creating more products, building infrastructures, just like China is doing, Belt Road Initiative, railroads, etc. The whole purpose of it is to make a better life for people so that they are working less hard, and they have more, and they're doing it with less. A good example of unproductive forces, two good examples, is investment in the military, right? Like the military claims a profit, but they're destroying productive forces, right? So that's an example of unproductive forces where, the military capitalists are claiming, oh, we made this much profit this year, but they ignore the fact that they are building things that either are not used in wars, that just sit there, and they're not producing anything, or they're actually killing thousands of people. But that counts for capitalists as profit. The other unproductive force, as you know, is finance capital.
Yeah, financialization.
Yeah, finance capital is you're claiming a profit off of stocks, bonds, derivatives that are not going into the social organism, and with this, people get something back from it. It's just they make profits on paper, they hoard the paper, and those things are unproductive. And those are things. What's interesting, Jeff, is if you look at the history of capitalism and the different cycles it's gone through. This is not quite on my lecture, but I'll just mention it because I think people will be interested. In the history of capitalism, there's been four Giovanni Arrighi calls four cycles or hedgehogs. One is the Italian city-states in the 14th and 15th century. The second cycle of capitalism was with the Dutch in the 17th century. The third one is with financial industrial capitalists of England. And the fourth was the United States. And what he says is, in every one of those cycles, when you make a profit off A, the military, or B, finance capital, it's the end of your cycle and you're done. And there's going to be another one taking over. And you can see that where the United States is. The profits are made on military and finance capital. They don't invest. They invest in very little outside of the defense industry.
Yeah. His name is Giovanni what? I want to write that down.
His last, Giovanni Arrighi. It's A-R-R I-G-H-I.
I-G-R-H-S. That's a good Italian name. All right.
Yes. And his book is called The Long 20th Century.
Okay.
20th Century. And he's a great, he did some great work there. But anyway, so does that answer about productive, unproductive capital?
Yeah, thank you. I learned something. You talk about, why do you use the words centrism to describe the Anglo-American Empire? I mean, I just think of them as global capitalism, colonialism, imperialism. What inspires you to use the word centrism to describe the Anglo-American Empire?
Well, I agree with all the terms you're using to call it. I'm just saying that there are some people that make sense of the world in terms of the political spectrum, right? So, you know, you go to the political spectrum, if you start on the right, extreme right, you've got the libertarians, then you've got the fascists, and you've got the conservatives, and then you're getting, you know, closer to the center, and then you have New Deal liberals on the left, liberal on the little left of center, and then you got all the different kinds of socialists, social democrats, various kinds of Leninists, anarchists, etc. And my point is that the reason I'm bringing this up is because the neocons and the neoliberals are identifying themselves as essentially they're in the middle. And so even though the neocons' foreign policy is clearly right wing, the Democratic Party and the liberals are allowing them to do what they want in foreign policy, like with Victoria Nuland and, you know, her husband, Robert Kahn. But they're really, the liberals, the neoliberals, are really sort of in the center of the political spectrum. They are letting the neocons do what they want, but they kind of have a lockdown on any movement one way or another. Like if you for these people, if you challenge them, you're either a fascist on the right or you're a communist on the left.
Mm-hmm.
And their job is to keep anything forming between the right and the left. So they'll always say, you know, what I was mentioning before about the People's Party, if you get on the same stage with somebody that might be more right wing, I mean, you're discredited. You may as well not even be on the stage. And, you know, if in the vision of these centrists, if you challenge the Democratic Party at all, you're a communist. And so there's this kind of alliance between liberals and there's an alliance between the neoliberals and the neocons to sort of block out this center and keep any other groups from
talking
to each other, right?
Okay, interesting. All right. Well, so, you've listed some interesting in your notes that you sent me, you talked about how, of course, you know, a massive tool that they use, that you're talking about, the neoliberals and the neocons, that they use to keep people divided is identity politics.
Right.
You know, wokeism, right. You know, pro-environment, you know, anti global warming, all this wokeism craziness and races, you know, blacks and whites and and browns and yellows and everything. They're constantly, you know, Democrat, Republican, you know, blue state, red state. I mean, they go to great lengths, you know, gay, straight, you know, they go to, you know, guns, no guns, God, no God, you know, they're constantly promoting this to keep everybody pissed off at each other.
And also, I'm sorry, Jeff.
No, I'm just saying, but unfortunately it works. That's the sad part about it, is it works.
The elephant in the room is social class. They don't want, they'll never talk about social class. And it's social class that would make people talk, that would allow people to talk to each other, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that some of the people that are, I think, less rigid would recognize that, you know, the people that voted for Trump, most of the base that voted for Trump was small businesses, you know, petty bourgeois, small owners. Some working class voted for Trump, but those people are not necessarily people that we should not talk to, you know, like that we need to talk to working class people around the issue, economic issues around class lines, and not just say we cannot touch them. And that's, you know, I think that's very important. Jeff, I wanted to mention some examples of why we need to think about the political spectrum in a new kind of way. Okay, let me give you some real life examples of this. One is that the political spectrum, the traditional one, the linear one, can't account for the following. One is China forming alliances with non-socialist countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it could, you know, it maybe in the old communist way, I don't know whether they would do this or not, but typically, if you're a socialist society and you're dealing with a country that is like a fundamentalist, Islamic fundamentalist, you'd say, oh, no, they're reactionaries, you know? And the Chinese premier is not doing that. He's crossing the line between right and left and saying that that's not going to stop us, right? So that's an example of China sort of crossing over to a kind of right-wing reaching out to a right-wing government and say, okay, let's talk about what we have in common. And so that the political spectrum would not allow that. Another thing is like the Social Democrats, instead of forming alliances with communists, right? Mm-hmm. They form alliances with imperialists. So you've got, for example, supposedly the party in Germany, the SPD, is an old Marxist party. And then they have a coalition government with the German Greens. So when you look at those, you figure, okay, they're going to be, you know, they're certainly going to be left of center and they're going to be like social democrats. But instead of aligning with socialist countries like Venezuela or China, they're on the side of the imperialists. They're on the side of the United States. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's another example of how you can't count on people to just stay in the same position on the political spectrum because times are changing. Mm-hmm. I'll just bring up one more. You know, the Indian government, Modi's Indian government, right? He's a fundamentalist, a Hindu fundamentalist. That didn't stop him from forming alliances with China, which is, you know, the evil communist country. So, mm-hmm. I think internationally, the boundaries of the political spectrum are changing, and we really need a new political model to express these things, so that it makes it more possible to understand what's really going on, because the political spectrum is important, and people need it as a theoretical tool, and they ask questions about it. So we've got to have a better model that can account for all these type of exceptions to the rule.
Yeah, you mentioned in your notes, and of course, you know, I live here in France and I'm a dual national, and you mentioned, you know, the recent elections in France in which Le Pen, who is the, everybody here wants to call her a fascist, but she's not, it's just identity politics to destroy her. She would be almost a liberal in the United States. But anyway, she's supposed to be a fascist, but her social programs are much, much more pro people mm-hmm. than Macron, who is supposed to be a right. supposed left guy. Yeah. You know, that he came from the Socialist Party. But yep. in fact, he's a hardcore neoliberal. So it's just yep. Everything's just mixed up. And then you also mentioned, you know, the neoliberal Democratic Party in the United States supporting fascist Ukrainian
right.
people and keeping them in power. So
right.
Those are some alliances that we could do without.
Right. That's right.
But they're happening.
That's right.
Your last point, the anti-communist forces of the Anglo-American Empire have shaped a fake opposition, in other words, controlled opposition is what I call it.
Right.
And the romantic new left, the ones that you were describing, which says we should go back to tribal society mm-hmm. and live on our gut feelings, to oppose the continuation and development of enlightenment, the American system, and a communist movement. Can you please elaborate on that?
Okay, what I will do will be, I'm going to give you some examples of New Left ideology and how it supports the Anglo-American Empire. Okay, so...
Sure.
So one thing about the New Left is that typically it rejected Soviet Union, China, and Cuba, right? And they say, okay, that's not real socialism, you know, and they say, you know, we have to oppose that, and they're just as bad as the capitalist, something like that. Okay, so whose interest does that serve? That's good for the Anglo-American Empire because it's a tremendous loss of international identity. Like if you say you don't have any models of socialism in the world, and all you see is capitalism, you don't have models that you can point at, you know? And then you say, then you're stuck in this position of, you know, a conservative working class person saying, okay, so you're socialist, so where does it work? And if you've rejected Russia and China and Cuba because you have, you know, certain criticisms of them, then you lose credibility among working class people because you don't even have a model to say, well, over there they do this and over there they do that. So that benefits the Anglo-American Empire for you mm-hmm. to reject the existing socialist system. Another thing that happened is that, you know, when capitalism continued on into the 60s and 70s, the New Left lost confidence that capitalism has some kind of internal contradiction that will force it to be, will end the system, that there'll be a crisis that they won't be able to get out of and they'll destroy it. The New Left said, well, you know, capitalism has been pretty smart in figuring out how it can continue. And so they lost confidence in economic analysis of things. And so the benefit for the Anglo-American Empire of this is it demoralized people from imagining that capitalism had real weaknesses. And they just say, well, it's ingenious. And then it makes people feel like, well, we have to overthrow capitalism by just by our voluntary will. It's not a matter of that it has internal problems. And in fact, you could see, Jeff, I mean, I remember, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you'd have leftists that were Marxists that wouldn't even use the word capitalism itself because they thought, you know, that maybe that was like old fashioned, or maybe capitalism had come up with some ideas to keep it from floating, and so we shouldn't use that word because maybe we'll alienate the workers. And so they lost the vocabulary of calling things capitalism. And they were also, on the other hand, afraid to call things socialist because, you know, socialism might alienate the workers. So they lost two of the most important words in our vocabulary, which is the capitalist crisis and what can replace it. And so, you know, imagining that capitalism can go on forever was very important for the Anglo-American Empire to continue its reign. I'll make we'll see how much time we have, but one other point I want to make is the New Left renounced the idea that socialism had to be based on abundance. So what they did was they made it seem as if the idea of wanting more and wanting a higher standard of living, that was something that people maybe shouldn't aspire to do because that makes people greedy. That makes people, you know, they might say something like, well, we already have too much. And so they would be falling back on socialism as sort of a moral thing, like it would be good to have socialism because we would have because it's the right thing to do, and it'd be sort of creative socialist ethics, as opposed to saying no, we have the scarcity that we're experiencing is socially constructed. It's not. It's something we want more. We want a better life. And we're not ashamed to say we want the economy to grow and expand. So they renounced the kind of sense that socialism should be based on abundance, and they walked away.
Yeah. Well, China's proving that you can have your cake and eat it too, because it's definitely I always tell people, and it upsets a lot of people, especially neoliberals, neocons, you know, conservatives. And it upsets a lot of liberals and lefties too when I say China is a communist socialist country. And they, oh, no, 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 no. It's capitalist. Ha, 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 ha. And I have gone through bottles of ink and rubbed calluses on my fingers typing, you know, to explain that that's just not true. So socialism can be extremely prosperous and wealthy, and it just depends on where you prioritize your resources. Human and natural. So I think China's the best model. Mm-hmm. On planet Earth right now. And then when you take countries like Cuba, which has had, you know, at least hundreds of millions, and some people have it up into the billions, mm-hmm. of dollars sucked out of Cuba's economy since 1959 because of the genocidal sanctions that the United States still will not lift. If you added all that money that was sucked out of Cuba's economy, where would Cuba be today? The same goes for Venezuela. There, even I think it was Harvard or some, bread and butter, Western organization calculated that the sanctions, the United States' sanctions against Venezuela are killing 19,000 people a year. Mm. Where would Venezuela be if it did not have war declared against it, and have, you know, built, stealing gold and stealing oil and stealing companies and stealing capital? Yeah. Where would Iran be today if although Iran is at least economically doing you know, quite well in spite of all the sanctions. But where would these countries be if they didn't have billions and billions and billions of dollars sucked out of their economies because of Western sanctions and blockades? So I think they'd be doing great, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Jeff, one thing I just want to mention, this is a little bit of a qualification, because I mean, I could see that maybe some people, some of your listeners might be saying, well, wait a minute, are you saying that the new left was the creation of the CIA and the Rockefellers? Okay, I'm not saying that, because the new left is a movement that developed, and they were, you know, they had the anti-racist component, they had an anti-war component, they were critical of conservative cultural institutions. All that is real. But I think there's a difference between creating something and shaping something. And I think the Rockefellers and the CIA saw what was happening with the new left. They couldn't control some parts of it, but they got into some of its institutions and shaped it and moved it in certain directions. And that's where, you know, the Congress for Cultural Freedom comes in, mm-hmm. where they shaped its ideology. You know, they turned the ecology movement into an anti-nuclear movement. And that, of course, benefited the oil industry because they didn't have to compete with nuclear power. So the ecology movement that was part of the New Left was really, a lot of it was shaped by the capitalist to turn people against nuclear energy so the oil companies would not have to directly compete with it. So, mm-hmm. so you know, they can shape things, but they can't create things. They have to, you know, because anything that comes out from the lower classes, they can't control that. But they can do things, throw money at certain areas, and they can shape it to turn in a certain direction. So that's very different from creating it out of, you know, creating it out of nothing.
Yeah, yeah, they tend to suborn what's out there, and they don't have to create anything. All they have to do is just, you know, use the imperial toolbox, assassinations, blackmail, right. bribery, extortion, fake news, false flags, you know,
right,
to corrupt all these different organizations. So well, Bruce, we're knocking on an hour.
Yeah,
I think this has been wonderful. I do not want to say goodbye. First off, what is your latest? Are you writing another book, or what's going on?
Not right now. I'm just really pumping out articles. That's kind of like my main focus right now. So
okay, that's fine. Yeah. I would also, before we hang up, I want to acknowledge Bruce's partner, Barbara McLean, who is a big part of the socialist planning beyond capitalism, their website, and everything that goes into it. They're very active on Twitter. I have a Twitter account, and they're doing a great job. They're doing a great job putting a lot of interesting stuff on Twitter, and I see it every day. And if it wasn't for Barbara, we wouldn't be here today, because she's the one that got your camera working. So,
That's right. That's exactly right. I'll tell her.
Well, listen, Bruce, this has been wonderful, and I will get it up. And of course, now I have a policy of I will not put out anything that I do, audio or visual, that I do not get transcribed first, so that way, when it's published, it's not only audio and video, but it's also written, mm-hmm. because I know some people like to read, some people like to listen, some people like to watch, and they're kind of like water, oil, and sand. They don't mix.
Yes.
And so it'll probably be a couple of weeks before I get this out, but it's in the hopper.
Okay.
This has been a great conversation.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it. I know the fans will too. Thank you. We'll be staying in touch.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.